Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Bob Cramer, John McCarron, Chris Roebling, and Chris Veronis. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Tonight, we're not going to talk exclusively about what happened in Boston and the intelligence investigations that perhaps could have prevented that. It will be a major part of our discussion. It will be the entire focus of our program in the second hour this evening for those listening to us on radio. But again, we're going to start with that subject because it's the subject that most people are still talking about. And I'm going to start with John McCarron, a longtime columnist for the Chicago Tribune, now an adjunct professor at DePaul University where he teaches journalism. As you look at this case, John, what is the most troubling aspect of what happened in Boston, and at least what we all think we know now about what the FBI knew and when they knew it?
Well, the most troubling aspect is that a couple of kids with not a lot of talent or expertise can kill some folks and injure scores of people with what probably is a homemade bomb. Now, that brings us to the question of what do we know and what do we know, how much help did they get, et cetera. I guess it troubles me a little bit that the FBI got a heads up from the Russians some time ago that about the senior of the two boys, and they questioned him, but apparently didn't follow up sufficiently. Yeah.
Chris Roebling also joins us. Chris, nice to have you with us. What is the most troubling aspect of this incident and investigation to you?
Well, I think as John implies, the introduction of soft targets and the introduction of sort of what would be random violence in clusters of civilians, and we're seeing this now. And I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to prepare for that. And there are going to be many ramifications for American urban life, and specifically. I think also on the side of the FBI, on the side of national defense, we have to be concerned that there were so many yellow flags about these two, including the Russian tip-off, including the trip back to the former Soviet Union, including the radicalization, and there just wasn't a step that impeded their action to the explosions.
I want to get Bob Cramer's reaction. Bob also joins us. Bob, nice to have you with us. What's troubling to you about this investigation and the incident?
Well, probably the failure to connect the dots the second time when he came back in the country, that is the older of the two brothers. Mm-hmm. But I would say this, though, Bruce. I mean, I think we ought to also focus on the remarkable performance of law enforcement, both at the federal and state and local levels, to apprehend these guys, to identify them and apprehend them in such a short period of time. That was a remarkable performance.
I don't think anybody denies that.
It's hard to prevent every opportunity for people who are have whatever reason decide they're going to kill their neighbors. I mean,
Chris Veronis also joins us. So that term, connecting the dots, we've heard that since 9/11. This is another example where this could have been prevented. And based on what we have at least read, it appears that by stopping these two guys, it prevented them maybe from doing greater harm in New York City.
Well, the story's still being written on this. We're getting new information. I think the latest is this mysterious figure, Misha. They know who it is. I personally think the most troubling thing to come out of this is another reminder that the intelligence agencies aren't talking to one another. In fact, there may be some competitiveness there. So it wasn't just the FBI that got the request for inquiry from the Russians. It was also the CIA, too. This window, the 7-month window when they went back to Dagestan.
And the Department of Homeland Security appeared to be the last group
exactly.
that was sort of brought into that mix.
And, right. and frankly, I think neither agency is very comfortable talking to the Russians.
Yeah.
For historical reasons, and maybe they have to get over that.
The post 9/11, there was the Office of National Intelligence Director that was created for this very reason.
Right.
To integrate all of the disparate intelligence True. Agencies, and so we're seeing that there's still some bugs in the machine.
Last week, we spent a lot of time talking about the issue of, again, two kids. We don't know to what extent they may have had help from outside, but at the moment, it looks like it may have just been them, and they were able to shut down an American city. As you look at what the law enforcement did, mm-hmm. in your view, Chris, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. did they do the right thing by shutting that city down, or does that embolden other 19-year-old punk kids somewhere around the world that think that they can do the same thing?
We were confronted by the ticking time bomb scenario, okay, where we didn't know if there was a ticking time bomb, and so you have to take these extra steps. This is why life in urban America is going to change. It's already begun to change, but this is a watershed point. I want to say I'm...
So every police department and every mayor is going to have to do this from now
on. I think that every police department, every mayor, all of the National Guards are going to be looking at this case. They're going to be looking at the fact that these resources were marshaled that quickly. They're also going to look at the fact that during the period of sort of stay at home, rest at home that they were saying, mm-hmm. they did not find them. They only found them when they loosened it. And this again, very eloquently underlines the fact that law enforcement is as good as the relationship between the uniformed or badged officers on the one hand and the civilians. Because it was the gentleman who went out for a smoke. And then he heard this thing.
But another very important part of this, and Bob, I know you are a civil libertarian. You have been for your entire life. Okay. One of the things that came out of this, and one of the reasons why you just gave an accolade to the security, the police departments for being able to identify these guys, was because of all the cameras that captured this. Are we looking to a point where there's going to be a lot more cameras in a lot more places in a lot more cities?
That is true. And there's no stopping the plethora of increased video.
Are you worried about that?
I am worried about
Why?
That. It's not the number of cameras. It's the ability to increasingly search the databases of video to find both face recognition and signatures of people. I mean, on the one hand, we have to desperately avoid the kind of privacy questions implicit in kind of the Big Brother scenario where the government always knows where you are. On the other hand,
don't the majority of people want that, though?
Well,
because they want to be protected.
I think what the majority of people want is to have this technology controlled so that it's used when it's appropriate and never when it's not. And that's a serious challenge,
Chris,
for all of us.
I think public cameras, Chicago is second only to London, I think, for having the most amount of cameras in the world. Public cameras, surveillance cameras are in different places. I don't think you could apply this blanket of insidiousness across the board. I don't know what the case was in Boston, but I do know that several cameras delete their footage from if it's a week old.
Right.
So they only have a week on hand.
But they also had access to 7-Eleven, convenience stores. I mean, there's a lot of places that have cameras that are not government related. We're going to pause right
now.
1-800-723-8289, back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for being with us. We're going to go to calls right away. Let's go to Edward, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. I'm hoping they have congressional hearings because I'd like to have the FBI director and Eric Holder giving testimony about their incompetence.
Right.
I mean, as we know in 9/11,
right,
there's these people who are doing training classes in Florida, and guess what? They don't want to learn how to land.
They don't want to learn what?
They don't want to learn how to land the plane. You don't remember that?
Florida. All right, but the question is, and Chris made the point, is that since 9/11, there was going to, we've spent billions of dollars beefing up the federal intelligence and the alleged cooperation. And we should say, and I think it's very important to say, is that terrorists only have to get through once.
That's right.
We have all kinds of evidence that American intelligence has thwarted a variety of incidents in this country and around the world. So we take our hats off to them. We think they did a wonderful job, but that doesn't mean that the public should not continue to ask and demand whether or not all of that money is being wisely used. And part of it may be, and I think Chris alluded to it, part of it may be just good old-fashioned governmental, you know, turf wars that exist and have existed, in bureaucracies, for centuries now. So, by the way, in the second hour, I just want to put a little plug in. In the second hour, for those listening to us on radio, Mike Kirk, who is a producer for Frontline, this coming Tuesday night, Frontline is doing a series called Top Secret America, and they are going to be looking not only at what happened in Boston, but tracing it back to 9/11. And so the second hour this evening, we've got some bona fide experts on that will be talking about that.
But I want to make a political point here. I mean, I think that the Obama administration ought to take this incident and look very closely at itself in the mirror, and it ought to ask itself why it has a problem understanding Fort Hood, why it had a problem understanding the Islamo-fascist terrorist aspect of this event, why you've got Eric Holder sitting in Washington and you've got Director Mueller at the FBI and you've got this judge up in Boston, and there is this sort of, at the very best, you've got a disconnect about are we interviewing this suspect or are we Mirandizing this suspect. There are a lot of divots that have got to be replaced by the Obama administration because they are responsible here 5 years in.
Really, I mean, Chris, this guy was interviewed as a consequence of the Russian, contact.
Right.
And there was no evidence apparent. Now, I don't know. I'm not privy to the details, but there was apparently no evidence that he was a danger, certainly in the United States. I mean, a lot of people, I think, were concerned potentially that the Russians thought he might be a problem in Russia, where Chechens and Russians have been doing battles for a long time.
Right.
But the Russians told American intelligence about this guy.
They said he was a potential radar threat. That's right.
They put him on the radar before he went to Russia.
Well, that's right.
I think lay people have a hard time understanding the amount of noise that's inbound and that has to be interpreted, and the wheat separated from the chaff, both in phone calls and internet correspondence, and in tips from other governments. It's a matter of prioritization, getting to it. And I think Chris Roebling makes a real mistake by trying to politicize this thing. I know this is talk radio, so we got to blame Obama, but I think that's a real mistake here.
Is the administration, I'm gonna stick up for what Chris's point, and that is, does this administration, are they less likely to talk about the possibility of an international involvement or a conspiracy involving foreign people somewhere? Maybe it's their mother. I mean, the number one suspect in this case, they've stopped
numerous of these since he's been president. George Bush is the guy who presided over 3,000 people dying at 9/11. But Bob, you're now politicizing.
What I'm saying is, is this administration less likely to use the T word, that these guys were terrorists?
What is the point of that? I mean, the question here is whether or not they're doing the best job possible to protect the United States, and whether law enforcement and the intelligence agency of the United States could do better.
I think there may be ways
they could do better, but it's not because they are somehow unwilling to use the T word. This is a question.
Just to use an example, in Syria, President Obama says, we're going to establish a red line. Now, maybe he should have, maybe he shouldn't have. The fact is that he did. He made that choice. He said there is a big red line. And if anybody uses nerve agents, poisonous gas, then that is crossing the red. Okay, so now we have the UK, France, Israel, and the United States assessing the use of.
Correct.
Okay. And President Obama And I'm not saying he's wrong in doing so, but he's now saying, well, it's not really a
revolution. He's,
not
he's a taking a deliberate approach.
When you cannot, okay,
he's
I'm
soft,
not,
soft but, on terrorism. But
when I, no. I think he's ill-advised in his attempt to conduct foreign policy.
Oh,
that's very different.
We should invade.
No, I'm not saying that.
There's a recruiting station. There's a recruiting station on Van Buren on the west side.
But I am saying,
wait a minute, we're moving to a discussion of Syria, which I don't want to go there yet.
I understand, but here, if he cannot categorize Fort Hood as a terrorist act, and he wants to categorize it as workplace violence, then the problem with not being able to use the T word is he doesn't understand what we are facing.
Chris, when you have a terrorist act, and that's what it was, objectively speaking. I don't think anyone...
Now,
absolutely.
You can't disabuse.
The president on the day of the event was having problems with that. But now we all understand.
He's caught up about it. And I think when something on this scale happens, you know, and by the way, I mean, the point is valid. We've thwarted many terrorist attempts.
Right.
Fact. There is a lot of noise in the machine. Fact.
Yeah.
And at the same time, this, by terrorist standards, was pretty amateurish terrorist act.
Home-baked.
Yeah, for sure.
In the apartment.
You know, there was a story. There's a story that I read that the older brother was on welfare for a long time. These guys were amateurs, clearly. And I think terrorists want to outdo each terrorist act. But when something like this happens, you cannot not assign accountability. I don't know if it goes all the way up to the doorstep of the White House, but there is some legitimate fault for the president or the intelligence director for not getting a hold of the intelligence bureaucracy.
You can certainly try and learn.
I think that's, where we got to train the crosshairs.
I agree. Should be.
Well, what about the FBI is actually gathering intelligence from the subject, and we've got this crazy interruption to Mirandize the subject, at which point the subject –
shuts up.
Essentially,
and
lawyers
and that's
up.
Different, Chris. And
no,
you've
no,
got
it's
a point there.
It is. I'm
you're
distinguishing.
Right.
I'm saying this is an additional source
of
concern.
Bottom line.
That's fine. John, what do you think of what Chris just said there?
From what I heard, I think it was necessary to give the gentleman his rights. I think the judge who came to the hospital bed didn't necessarily have to have a lawyer at her side, so he would be able to immediately exercise that right. I think it's quite possible that if they strategized a little more, they could have kept them talking for a longer period.
But who is in charge?
Chris continues to want to politicize this by laying blame, et cetera,
Wait. Just for you, John. Let's pull back because you think that Chris is politicized. Now you're a journalist. You've raised the possibility that maybe the judge jumped the gun and got there too quickly. So let's play that out with your own thoughts on this issue.
Well, one of my thoughts, I thought we were tapping the right vein earlier in the conversation when we talked about what does this mean about, and Chris rightly says it's going to change urban living. I hope it doesn't change urban living that much. Frankly, I don't want to be patted down every time I go to a ball game or a department store. However,
but you will be when you go to baseball game. They wand you at least.
They'll look
to
in
sell,
your backpack, but I don't do a body cavity search.
Let's hope not, Janet.
I think we will see more cameras. I think this is going to greatly affect that debate. I think that debate is almost over for the time being. I think it's going to raise a lot of questions about wiretaps, and about how much we want the federal government to monitor. I think the public is going to say, monitor away, but why are we stopping my Aunt Mary from taking her hairspray on an airplane? You know, in other words, we've got to kind of reset what works and what doesn't.
We need to get to this issue that Chris raised about Mirandizing. The subject of this investigation is an American citizen. We believe in due process in America. That's what we're standing up for here. I mean, the idea that he should somehow be treated as an enemy combatant at the whim of the federal executive is astounding to me.
But Bob, of course, I'm not saying that.
Wait a second.
Let him finish.
The point of the matter is that there's an exception allowed by the Supreme Court for a short period of time to deal with imminent threats, after which he has to be read as a Miranda rights. That's what American citizens have to have done. He could not have been treated as an enemy combatant under the law, period. And the people who say they could are just blowing smoke.
Bob, of course, I'm not saying that. That's a false choice. Here is the point that I am making. you have just expressed greater clarity, okay, greater clarity about the terms of engagement with that subject than we saw on the afternoon in question, the Monday afternoon, from the Obama administration. If what you say, if you had been the director of the FBI, then the folks in Boston interviewing the subject would have known before the judge walked in with the attorney to say, I don't care what's going on. I personally am going to stop this. We're going to Mirandize. In other words, no one knew what they were doing.
That is just
that's not politicizing, John. That is not politicizing. That's just reporting.
John, I mean, was Bob mentioned earlier, is the quickness with which they were able to go through the videos. They were able to put them their pictures on television, put them in the newspapers, and so they quickly the heat was on these guys. And so much so, they went up and they basically bragged to the guy, you know, whose car they stole.
Right.
And they basically, they admitted what they had done at that particular point. We've got to pause. I've got lots of callers on the line. 1-800-723-8289. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Bob Creamer is here. And Bob has written a book. And the name of your book is?
Listen to Your Mother, Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win.
And you have been an active member of the progressive movement in Illinois for many, many years. Chris Voronis also joins us. He is the head of ASOP Communications. That's a public relations consulting firm. John McCarron also joins us, longtime columnist for the Chicago Tribune, now a adjunct professor at DePaul University, where you're building relations with a new generation of journalists. And Chris Roebling also joins us. He is a principal with Jane C. Thompson and Associates, and once upon a time was the executive director of the Cook County Republican Party. We have lots of callers on the line. Let's go to Tom, listening to us on WKBN in Youngstown, Ohio. Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce, and to your guest. I have three quick points here, and like your guest's comments. First of all, I think Janet Napolitano needs to justify her paycheck. The purpose of having a Homeland Security Department was to be able to connect the dots, and as Bruce pointed out, they seem to be the last to know in this instance. Second, that we need a profile behavior, and as I understand it, the warrant to investigate the situation was only like 90 days that the FBI had to look at the background at the dead terrorist, and I think that that should be indefinite once they get on a list. And the third point is, I think the news media and consultants need to be muzzled. You know, we can be an open society without being a stupid society. And this idea of giving step-by-step instructions on how to make a pressure cooker bomb, or that Al-Qaeda has a website, or even going back to 9/11, when shortly after that, Osama bin Laden was giving speeches in the mountain, and somebody in the media let it be known that the administration was looking at the background to see where, if they could tell where he might be. From that point on, there was a big sheet behind him every time he gave a speech. We've got to become smart and not stupid.
All right, well, let's just pick on one aspect of that, and that is, Chris, let me start with this here, Chris Voronis. The Internet. I mean, how much freedom do we really have in the country, and does the average person, do they want the government to have the ability to monitor every single conversation that takes place on the Internet?
Well, and so I think that's the true culprit. It's not so much what the caller said as the stupid journalism, although there's plenty of that. Certainly with this coverage, including jumping the gun in some cases. But the information's out there. It's a mouse click away. I will say, though, and I remember listening to a radio interview, this Al-Qaeda website, Inspire, there's some pretty ridiculous and hokey things on there. Laughable, you know, right. Cutting off lawnmower blades and welding them onto a car and driving them into an audience. So these are prescribed terrorist acts, or putting cooking oil on the expressway to cause, you know, massive car pileup. It's just some ridiculous things.
We can't stop that. Are you suggesting
we
stop it?
No, we can't.
Should we
stop
monitor
it,
those people who go to those sites?
I think the important point here is you have to look at this for what it was, and this could have been a lot worse. Very tragic, no matter which way you look at it. Three people dead, several people lost limbs, injured. But this
176
was
76 people.
You've got to look at this for what it was. It wasn't a mass murder event.
I think the caller, Tom from Youngstown, used a very important phrase, and that was to observe behavior. And I think that's where the government is going to end up finding its center relative to surveillance. I think that behavior is going to have to be the tripwire, because if the government is not out there looking at what's going on, then it's impossible to connect the dots.
You know, though, I mean, many ways was an individual event, I'm afraid. I heard an interview right the day of the event, I guess, maybe the day after, with a talk show host in Boston whose nephew was one of the best friends of this younger guy, who was just normal guy. Right. To all appearances, went to proms, was a happy-go-lucky guy. I mean, you observe behavior, all right, right. But it's hard to catch all these circumstances.
I'm talking about here's the behavior I'm talking about. The behavior I'm talking about is going to a website that the government has deemed as unacceptable, and the government has the ability to do that. They do that. They can do that right now. So the question is, if someone is exercising their right of expression and searching the website, and they go to a website that's a radical website, should they end up on a list, John McCarron?
I think we have laws about wiretapping, and it requires a judicial approval. I could see this leading, however, towards some sort of pre-approval, where you give some national security apparatus the ability to, within certain defined bounds, to do what amounts to a wiretap or a web traffic search.
But the public, I want to get back to what the public wants. You know, the civil libertarians want one thing. The broader public, their attitude might be, you know what, I don't care. I'm not doing anything wrong. You can listen in on every phone conversation. You can monitor my internet. But because the point now is behavior, I mean, in the area, one of the fastest growing crimes in America is child pornography. It's the Department of Homeland Security that investigates that.
Most Americans don't
want government.
So that's
something that they look into.
Most Americans don't want government prying into their private lives excessively. This is a very difficult problem. It's been there since the beginning of the Republic, but new technology has made it much more front and center. And I think those Americans, and I think most Americans, who are concerned with their privacy over the long haul and are not looking to have Big Brother, are going to be concerned about making sure that those lines are drawn very, very carefully.
Bruce, the five of us easily could have gone to that Al-Qaeda website just to see what's on there.
Absolutely.
Does that mean we wind up on a list?
Well, that's my point. There's two questions here. When do you get on a list? And if you are someone who was on the list, and you are exercising and you are doing things that are going to take your interest in, let's say, a terrorist activity, and you're going to move it to the next level. When does that get red flagged? And in this particular case,
when you
this guy was
a PDF.
This guy was red flagged.
Well,
he's under the radar.
Well, he's going to the website. He's going back to Russia. He has been flagged by Russian Secret Service to CIA and FBI. Somewhere along the line, somebody has got to be able. This is the failure of, and I'm not politicizing this particular element, but this is where the billions we have spent and all of the time, effort, and treasure put into Department of Homeland Security and the director of National and DNI, that new edifice down there in Washington, all of that failed in this case.
That's it.
We're going to go to Carlos, listening to us in Houston, Texas, on XM Satellite Radio. Always good to hear from Houston, Texas. Go ahead.
Amen. Just two quick points there. Number one, this is what the problem is. We allow the Supreme Court to create rights. This Miranda right, as far as I'm concerned, should go out to the toilet. Number two, we're pussyfooting around the subject. You guys are saying, well, what's the tripwire? The tripwire is young men between the ages of 18 to 32 or 35 who are Islam, okay, who are involved in Islam. That's the tripwire. You guys keep going around the issue, and that's where it
well,
lies.
Well, it's a common denominator, but it isn't necessarily the tripwire.
This is where the civil libertarian has got to rise up in every American. There are a lot of believing Muslims who are male and 24 years old who are no closer to being a terrorist than anybody listening
that's
to this
what
program.
Say.
And what
that's
about
what
and what about
say.
What about
ahead,
what
Charles.
About young men who are what about young men who are of that same age group who are also prone to be part of militias or right have right wing attitudes? Should they be profiled the same way? Wait a second. Should they be profiled the same way? Remember, the biggest terrorist event before 9/11 was a guy just like that.
He was not a
right
wing.
Who read the Turner report? Who read the Turner report and went against everything that any American would stand for? Okay, so don't bring up the militia that's the tripwire. No,
I'm asking you if that's the same.
Islam teaches to kill us. The non-believer. That's what Islam teaches.
Oh, it doesn't.
Hijacked Islam.
Chris Veronis.
In hindsight.
That is not a hijacked religion. The only reason you don't see every Muslim attacking us right now like they do in Israel is because they're under 40%. Once our population, if it ever happens, hits that 40%, that's when you're going to see those crazies go all out. Now, I don't care what you guys say or the government. I don't trust any Muslim.
All right, so let me ask you the question here. Okay, I want to get this perspective. Okay.
Okay.
What do you propose that we do if you had your way and you were the Attorney General of the United States? What would you do?
I would push to eradicate Islam from the Western Hemisphere. And I would start shipping them out as fast as possible.
Okay.
I mean, I'm telling you how I feel and how a lot of my friends feel.
Okay,
now,
Carlos,
a small group, but I think a lot of Americans, I mean, you guys in the news talk around the subject, but I believe the real Americans, true Americans who live this life every day, see Islam as an evil cult. And we would like to eradicate it from the Western Hemisphere.
Okay, well, we have plain speaking people, and we don't agree with you. I don't agree with your point. I think that you're lumping everyone together. I don't think that's a wise thing to do. I think you have to be selective. And what we're talking about tonight is the very difficult time that people have to zero in and separate those that are legitimate Americans. They can be Muslim Americans. And those that, you know, have a desire to do harm to the country.
And
how do we separate them out? That's what
that is an un-American attitude.
We have to pause. 1-800-723-8289. That was Bob Cramer. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We will go to calls in just a moment, but let me remind you, if you're listening to this program on radio, in the next hour, we're going to be joined by Mike Kirk. He is a producer for Frontline. This coming Tuesday night, they have a special called Top Secret America. He's going to be looking at this U.S. intelligence operation, an apparatus that we have in this country, finding out where it's doing its job well and where it's dropping the ball. That will be in the next hour. You will have an opportunity to ask questions to Mr. Kirk as well. And also, we will be joined by Claire Lopez. She'll be on in about an hour. She's a fellow with the Center for Security Policy, and she's a former CIA operations officer. Let's go to Gene, listening to us in Austin, Texas, on KLBJ. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. It's Singing Lady Banana Bread from Austin, Texas.
Yes, go ahead. I remember you.
Yes, and you know, the reason I had to call today, because I'm listening to you while I'm cooking again, and we were talking about the Sandy Hook. Should people get into the, monitoring, people would say mental illness.
Yes.
So my whole thing is, now that this tragedy has happened, honestly, guys, the footage I'm watching on television and what my friends are talking about, was that call earlier, was very interesting. I didn't agree with him. But you know what? Here's my opinion now. This is a 48-year-old Hispanic woman living in, raised and born in Austin, Texas. Is anything going to happen to the FBI and Homeland Security? Are they going to be penalized? Are there going to be charges brought about to anybody that dropped the ball there? Because obviously There was a ball dropped here.
Yes. I think it is Gene, I think it's very telling that FBI had these flags, had interviewed the older Tsarnaev, and yet on Thursday could not identify the older Tsarnaev from its prior involvement with him.
Exactly. And Houston, we have a problem.
So they had the FBI and the United States government, despite all of our time, effort, and treasure, had to put out to the public these photos. And that, to me, represents a pretty significant failure, which in turn represents these other problems, which I've been mentioning, like the fact that they didn't know if they were going to, how long they were going to treat this guy under the exception to Miranda and when they were going to convert him and Mirandize him. I mean, there are some plugs that were unplugged.
How do we, thanks, Gene, for your call. I want to sort of broaden the discussion, get everybody's reaction. How do we deal now with the mother? Because the mother and the father, they've had press conferences, back in Russia. They want to come to the United States.
Announced today they're dropping that plan.
Okay, well that
this afternoon they announced
because they would be arrested.
She would be arrested for shoplifting.
Right. Well, hopefully a lot more.
At least.
But clearly, in this particular case, she could have been the instigator. I mean, she could have helped radicalizing her own son. And how many conversations are we going to monitor between mothers and sons because mothers and fathers have influence on their kids? I mean, at what point do we stop listening to conversations like that? She is not alone. There's a lot of people like her who think like her.
No, and
sons.
If you're asking if we have the ways and means to kind of understand or listen in on conversations that are happening overseas, we do. She might be out of the reach of the arm of the law, though.
I will bet she is on the Russian watch list. And before
she very well could be.
I will bet
about it.
Whether or not she's going to be held to account for this is a different issue.
Let's go to Tom in Spokane, Washington. Go ahead. You're on the air. KXLY is the station. Go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Okay.
Here's my question. It seems like the definition of what a terrorist is just getting cloudier and cloudier, because I think if someone went into a grocery store, killed a bunch of people, and then shot himself, that would be murder. But if he shouted Allah Akbar beforehand, would he suddenly be considered a terrorist? I mean, where do we draw the line here?
Well, I think there are a variety of steps or a variety of, if you will, tests. I think there are a variety of gradations. There are gradations between a multiple victim public shooting and an act of terror. And the terror act usually comes down to motivation and comes down to the cause that the individual or individuals think is being served. So, yes, there are crazy people, or yes, there are people who go off the rails and go out and do a multiple victim public shooting, something like that. But when you have a stated link to a political ideology or a desire for a political outcome, then you have crossed over, and there are many gradations to get there,
John,
then you've crossed over into terror.
John, would you agree with that definition?
Well, I'm not sure it's as a clear, bright line as Chris wants it to be. And I would point out that, Al-Qaeda used automatic weapons very effectively in Mumbai, I think it was, several years ago. And I would also remind Chris and everyone else who's listening that you can still go to a gun show in these good United States and without a background check, buy an AK. So I'm curious about whether our Republican confreres here at the table think about that.
In fact, week and a half ago, many, many Republicans, not all, voted to allow terrorists to buy guns without background checks. That's what they voted to do. In fact, there was an Al-Qaeda recruitment video that one of the organizations I work with ran as part of an advertisement aimed at raising this issue where they basically said, you can buy weapons without a background check. What are you waiting for? Directly from an Al-Qaeda recruitment video.
But this is what I think frustrates people, is that when either side either side. And you know, Chris, you may have been guilty of it a little bit earlier when you brought up President Obama. Bob, I think you're guilty of it now, is that because of your own political desires or objectives, mm-hmm. you try to you cloud the issue when we're trying to focus on the specific issue of here's someone that was on a list. And the focus that we should have on this, which is where we started, and that is, who screwed up? What dot didn't get connected? Why didn't the person at Department of Homeland Security, why didn't the people at the FBI know about it? That's where this congressional investigation, it should be all about that. We shouldn't be trying to use it to make other political issues. On that moment, we have to pause. If you're watching this program on television, you can only imagine what we're going to talk about in the next hour. If you're listening to us on radio, we're going to have a producer from Frontline. We're also going to have a former security CIA officer. They will be all on in the next hour. We'll continue this discussion, and we'll get their insight when we continue on radio. Back shortly. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Where tonight we are welcoming Bob Creamer, John McCarron, Chris Roebling, and Chris Voronis. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you have questions or comments, if you have an email comment, you can send it to us at btb@museum.tv, and if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's www.beyondthebeltway.com. In the first hour, we were talking about the investigation into the Boston bombing, and we were asking the question and discussing whether or not the billions of dollars that have been spent by our government to protect us since 9/11, we're wondering whether those dollars are being wisely spent. And I guess to some extent, we sleep a little comfortably knowing that a number of terrorist plots have been thwarted by our intelligence operations. So that money has bought us some protections. And yet we have an incident in Boston, Massachusetts that really shakes us all a little bit when it appears that two relatively inconsequential and amateurish would-be terrorists who we still don't know the extent of their involvement with perhaps foreign direction, but we do know that they were radicalized. The older brother was radicalized, appears to be maybe radicalized by his mother, and we have a situation where there was some advance notification by the Russians to our intelligence leaders here to keep an eye on these guys. They went to Russia. They came back. They were interviewed by the FBI, and they fell through the cracks, and they were still able to get very close to the finish line of the Boston Marathon and kill three individuals, and also led to the death of a security officer at MIT, and also 176 people injured, some of them severely injured, some of them obviously having lost their limbs. One program that is coming up this week on PBS is Frontline. Frontline is one of the premier documentary programs in the history of American television. We will soon be joined by Mike Kirk, who is a producer of a special called Top Secret America. If that sounds familiar, it was a documentary that was done several years ago, but it has been updated because of what's happening in Boston and the investigation that goes on there. And we will bring Mike into that conversation in a matter of moments. But let us go to Patrick, who's listening to us in Austin, Texas, on KLBJ. Go ahead. You're on the air. Patrick, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Cool.
Patrick, are you there? All right, Patrick is not there. So, Mike Kirk is there. Okay, well, we're a little bit confused on our directions here tonight. But Mike Kirk, are you there in Boston?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
It's nice to have you with us. Thank you very much. And I gave a long vamp what we're talking about this evening. So let me turn to you and say, at this particular moment, we should mention, by the way, that Mike is the producer of Top Secret America. He's won numerous Peabody Awards, DuPont Columbia Awards. He did the original documentary a couple of years ago. And my question to you is, you've blown out what was supposed to play this coming Tuesday night at 10 o'clock Eastern time because of a new twist on this story that you have discovered. So what is the new information that will be elaborated on come Tuesday night on Frontline, Mike?
Well, I can't get too much into it, but I'm going to just say that people should definitely tune in to watch because it's going to blow a new view onto the whole situation.
Do we know, without revealing what obviously you want us to all watch on Tuesday night, do we know who dropped the ball on the communication between our intelligence apparatus?
Uh-oh.
Is he there? Mike?
Mike, are you gone? Well, I guess he's not going to talk. Patrick, are you there in Austin, Texas? Well, the gremlins, let's move on. Let's move on. We have the producer that we were not able to get to who's going to tell us to watch the show on Tuesday night and not tell us anything tonight.
Especially because he's doing a second edition, if you will.
Right.
I think he is picking up on the fact, and I think all Americans have to pick up on the fact, we've been talking about this for the last hour, that we've entered a new we've crossed some sort of threshold. We're in some sort of new era. And I think we're going to all have to be thinking about the relevance of the Fourth Amendment, which is the amendment that keeps privacy alive, physical privacy alive, mm-hmm. and causes the government and official agents of the government to have to go to an independent judicial arbiter, i.e. a judge, whether it's state or federal, right. to get a warrant to go and search something or to go and listen to somebody's phone conversation. Now, there have already been changes in this realm, but wherever we were 30 years ago, we're in a very different place today.
Or maybe a standing warrant that delegates to someone, not a judge, to make those decisions out in the field. I don't see an alternative to that.
The problem here is to – the reason the Fourth Amendment is there is to provide – as you say, an independent arbiter, somebody in the judiciary,
so is not
the responsibility to say, is the executive's decision to do something warranted by the facts or not? And the threshold that has to be reasonably rigorous if we're going to protect our privacy and have the kind of society that most Americans want.
When does your privacy end for the good of public safety?
Look, let's be clear here, guys. I mean, the odds of being killed in a terrorist incident is tiny in the United States today. Mm-hmm. Tiny.
I agree with
that. Compared to the odds of being killed in an auto accident or being killed by a gun violence incident.
Or living on the south or west side in gun violence.
Gun violence is huge relative to this. So
more people were killed in Chicago on the weekend of the Boston massacre.
That's right. And in each case, you have to weigh the rights of people, in this case, for instance, to bear arms, for instance, against the protection for public safety. And that's where, for instance, the background check bill is a reasonable line there, saying, well, you know, the same is true here. You have to weigh those two rights.
Well, let me ask you a question. You have, you made the point. I mean, obviously, you have been a leader for a long time on this the gun issue. How badly was the president hurt because he lost the gun battle? He had dead children.
Well,
he had dead children in Connecticut.
He was helped. I think it was almost a case of Republican entrapment that this was the most reasonable thing. 90% of the people
Why did he lose the first round.
We have not
but
lost
why?
The battle.
Because here's my question. Why?
Because
why
the Republicans exposed themselves to how unreasonable they are on the issue. Which, if you're looking toward 2014, which is where
Democrats. In fact, fellas,
I want to.
Tomorrow there will be polling released because we're involved in doing it. That to release this polling that will basically show that the number of the senators who voted no have taken big hits in terms of their public opinion.
Here's the most important Americans,
90% of Americans,
we're going to pause here and then we're going to come back. 1-800-723-8289. I don't know what happened to the frontline producer, but he is gone. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We are trying to connect the dots to find out what happened for this booking with this producer of Frontline who has this show coming up on Tuesday night called Top Secret America.
You've been promoing his show all night.
I've been promoting
his
show. I asked him a question. He didn't want to answer my question.
Maybe he thought he was under surveillance. Who knows?
Well, I think it's the NSA.
Given his background, he probably is because, I mean, this guy also is. I mean, by the way, let me just say, we have a little snafu here. This demonstrates, this is a live show, and we were going to have this guy on to talk. He really knows his stuff. He's a multi-award-winning documentarian, and I wanted to tell people to watch his show, and I hope they will watch his show because I'm sure there'll be good stuff because he certainly is not giving us any hit tonight other than, we reminded him that it is on Tuesday nights at 10 o'clock on PBS. So we'll
have to tune in. What the heck more?
He doesn't want to give anything away.
Well, I can talk about my show.
But you have an event coming up, and then we're going to move on. Tell us what you
on
have.
On the 15th of May in the morning at 7:30.
Let me get up
at the Union League Club. We're going to have a discussion about safety and security and privacy. And we've got David Hoffman, a former U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney. We've got civil libertarians.
Where can people go for information?
Come to Union League, ULCC.org, ULCC.org.
I want to, before we go back to calls, I do want to talk about Syria because that is another very important issue. There's major developments this week in that it appears that Syria has used chemical weapons on its people. We know how dastardly that is. And Chris Varonis, let me start this discussion with you. What should the United States be doing differently than it's doing now to send a signal to the Syrian government that we mean business, or don't we mean business?
Back up our words with actions.
Like what?
Pretty simple. Well, it just all goes back to this unfortunate use of words by the president, the red line. And then it's just sort of the squirrely, when he was asked about it on Friday, he backed off saying, well, it changes my calculus. So there's some important things we've got to realize here. One is the United States has recognized the opposition, the Syrian opposition, so that's a big deal. And that's been a long time in the coming. So for us to back off, that there'd be a use of force or some kind of consequence destroys their morale, destroys their momentum. On another level, there's a crisis going on right now in the Korean Peninsula. You've got North Korea, you've got Iran that are watching the words of the U.S., the president. And at the end of the day, there are few people in the world whose words have more consequence than the president of the United States. So I
Chris, what would you do in Syria? What would you do?
Yeah.
What do you recommend to the president?
This is not a prescription for action, Bob. It's not. But I'm just saying, when you come up with this red line terminology, you better have a plan. And it sounds like there was.
Well, he came up with that. I mean, that he got that from Netanyahu. He had a line, too.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is a very complicated
problem.
Which
got passed.
Syria. I mean, many of the factions involved in the Syrian civil war are proxies for other forces in the region, be they the Muslim Brotherhood, be they the Sunnis in Western Iraq,
the Shias,
be they the Shias who are close to the Alawites who run the government there, and be they the secular forces. It's a difficult problem. It is not like. I mean, there are a lot of things you could do. Theoretically, the Turks would be interested, for instance, in having a no-fly zone in the north. But that ain't like rolling off a log. The Syrians have very robust air defense.
But Bob, you're missing the point.
Well, I would say.
And the point is simply that you could easily see a case where the Syrian government, Assad, is trying to game this or just test the boundaries.
Sure, of course.
Where they don't do wholesale murders with chemical weapons.
No, I agree.
But just small scale and wait and see what the United States
does. The important thing is that, frankly, I am very pleased that this president is being very deliberate in determining what force, if any, should be used. I am absolutely against boots on the ground. And
there's Dick Cheney when we need him to
wipe
out those weapons of mass destruction.
This is a very difficult
problem. After the purchase of yellow cake. Another thing it could be, Bruce, it could have been a rogue company commander who used a weapon he wasn't supposed to. And I think this is all being checked out. And if you don't think the Sixth Fleet has op plans for taking out the Syrian Air Force and other military assets, then I guess you've never operated with the Sixth Fleet.
I want to ask this question of our Democrats. When do you cross the line? When is too much to take? When do we get to that point? What's the line?
Well, I think first we need to find someone to support. Right. I imagine we've got people on the ground who are running around from camp to camp trying to figure who we could actually get behind, who has some mojo, who could actually pull this thing off. And I'm afraid one of the reasons there's so much hesitancy here is that we're not finding these people, that the people that the opposition forces that are ascendant right now happen to be the guys that we don't want to support.
Hold on.
The same people we've been talking about all hour. I mean, it's a very complicated problem.
All right.
It is not one. Okay. I mean, if you can't tell us what you would do,
can I please? Just like last hour, FBI Director Bob Cramer was clearer about what was going on than the Obama administration in Washington. Here tonight, the national security team of McCarran and Cramer have been much more clear than the Obama White House. I don't minimize the complexity. I don't minimize the seriousness. 75,000 innocents have been slaughtered here.
That's correct.
So I don't want to hear people saying, I think it's great that the president isn't sure yet what to do. If the president of the United States, and this is not 12 minutes after Dick Cheney and George Bush walked out of the White House, we're not talking about January 2009. They've been in for 4.5 years.
Talking about an intemperate move that costs trillions of dollars and thousands of lives. That's all I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about, and here's what I'm talking about. I didn't say red line. Your guy, the president, introduced that concept,
and
he wasn't ready to back it up. Hold on.
Why do you believe he's not ready to back it up?
That makes him look ridiculous.
Why do you believe he's not ready to back it up?
That makes him look ridiculous to the Koreans.
Why do you believe he's not ready to back it up, Chris? I mean,
because he backed off.
One at a time.
Bob Cramer. Wait a second. I would be very surprised if it is established that there was in fact an intentional use of chemical weapons, that the administration doesn't take actions that it considers appropriate response beyond what its current actions are. And I'm not suggesting, by the way, there are various forces in the administration, I'm sure, that are eager to have various types of responses that may not be current. But it's not as if there is some easy solution
you're
to this
pleading
very
for
difficult
understanding,
problem.
No, I'm understanding not pleading for understanding. That you never gave Bush.
Well, Bush made
you
a decision that was one of the most disastrous.
Understanding that you never gave when the shoe was on the other foot. Now you're experiencing the shoe of government. You're experiencing the responsibility that goes with public office, and this administration cannot handle it.
Bush made one of the most disastrous foreign policy decisions.
It says there's going to be a red line. That's not an intemperate remark by a Republican.
That's a Democrat.
And you can't get him out of that box.
Back. John McCarran, the floor recognizes Senator McCarran.
Yeah, I don't understand why our Republican friends insist that action would be taken as soon as there was a report of nerve gas or whatever.
That's what the president said.
He didn't say immediately.
He didn't say immediately. And if you're are you still willing to defend?
I'm still trying to find out, because you have said not only on this program, but you've said on numerous appearances that you've been on the show. You've been on the show for 10 years now. You frequently criticize that the Republicans are too trigger happy. You've taken a slap at President Bush and certainly Dick Cheney. My question to you is, as a Democrat, and you're a Democrat and also a journalist, in some cases synonymous.
And a veteran.
And a veteran. That's correct. Pride of Rhode Island. My question to you is this. When do you push the button? When do you call in the troops? What has to happen before a tried and true patriotic liberal American says, you know what? It's time to go the military action.
This isn't about politics or being liberal or whatever. This is about cause and effect. I need a strategy I need to game this out.
That's right.
To get to a point where my side wins.
Or game it out. Game it out on
game
for
it
Syria.
Out. So I
game
need
it out
someone.
Syria.
I need someone to support. Okay. And as soon as I can identify that person and get some aid to him, then I could. Remember how we were crucified for leading from behind in Libya? Well, I would lead from behind again. We would take out their air assets, take out various other war making. Their armor. It could all be done, I believe, relatively effectively. But I might want to have the Russians at least say that would be not an act of war against them before I did it.
To the American who's listening to this program right now, and they say, you know what? Syria Shmeria, why do we care? Why do we care if this guy gasses his people? It's not bothering me in Poughkeepsie, New York. Why do we care? What's the answer?
Well, it's been a hotbed in foreign policy for the last 30 years. And I
what
think
does it mean to the guy in Poughkeepsie? How does it change his life? What does he care? What does he care if Assad gasses his people?
We just spent 2 weeks going through a domestic situation here that basically emanates from this East-West, this Muslim-Christian way. I mean, and this is the open sore in that divide. And it's been going on throughout the Middle East.
So if we go in and do anything, we're just exacerbating a circumstance.
Well, let's be clear. Look, the Libya.
We got to pause, and then we'll be back. Back shortly with a guest on the phone. Bruce Suman back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Bob Creamer is here. He is a partner in Democracy Partners, a leading progressive in the Chicagoland area. John McCarron also joins us, longtime columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and also now an adjunct professor at DePaul University, where he teaches young journalists. Do you ever run into young journalists who are conservative, John?
Oh, sure.
Do you give them good grades?
Oh, yeah.
You make their life difficult?
Yeah, but I tend not to teach, they want me to teach that, and we'll see what happens. I mean, essays and opinion writing, but generally speaking, I'm a news writing kind of guy.
Okay. Chris Voronis also joins us. He is the president of ASOP Communications, and Chris Roebling also joins us. He is with Jane C. Thompson & Associates, and they are both public affairs consulting firms, both with the Republican pedigree. And joining us now, we welcome Claire Lopez to the show. Claire, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway tonight.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Claire is a fellow with the Center for Security Policy and the Clarion Fund. She's a former career operations officer with the CIA and the executive director of the Iran Policy Committee. And my question to you, which is a question that we've been discussing on this broadcast, as you look at what happened in Boston, we're concerned that the intelligence apparatus, which we've spent billions of dollars in building up since 9/11, did not properly connect the dots. What about this story concerns you most based on what you know?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that the FBI, which is obviously full of dedicated and patriotic officers trying their best, but they did drop the ball. They failed to connect the dots. And I would suggest that the reason, or one of the reasons, maybe put it that way, that they were unable to understand the threat posed by these two brothers, the Tsarnaev brothers, in particular the older one, Tamerlane, whom the Russians warned them about as long ago as 2011. One of the reasons that they failed to do that is that all of the training within the United States government that would teach officers at the FBI, CIA, Department of Homeland Security, on down to local law enforcement, all such training, the curriculum, the PowerPoints, the presentations, and the instructors themselves, who would teach the connection between Islamic law, doctrine, scripture, and Islamic terrorism has been purged. You are not allowed, it is forbidden, to teach the ideology, where the ideology comes from, that animates and motivates jihadis, like the Tsarnaev brothers, to commit acts of jihad.
So, Claire,
terrorism, as we would say.
Chris Roebling.
Great to have you on the program. I want to ask you if you would then take the listeners of this program inside one of those briefings and give us a sense of how those training officers walk their charges through the explanation for this type of event without drawing those connections, as you say, between radical Islam and political terror.
Well, before they were discharged, before they were purged, the information that they would provide would have allowed these officers at the FBI to understand that when the Russian services came to them 2011 and said Tamerlane is becoming more religious, more devout, more pious, more Islamic, the Russians knew what that meant. The Russians understood that when a Muslim who might have been a nominal Muslim before begins to study his faith, begins to learn what the doctrine actually says, what the scriptures actually say, the commandment, the absolute immutable commandment therein that every single Muslim must, has an obligation to participate in jihad. It can be nonviolent jihad, pre-violent jihad, or violent jihad, but the obligation is for every Muslim for all time until the world is conquered for Allah. This sounds absurd, I'm sure, to many Westerners and Americans. How can this be? Well, that is because Islam is not just a religion. It is a political ideology, and they're intertwined to the point you cannot separate them.
In this particular case, I want to go back to trying to delve into where this ball was dropped. In your view, again, based on either what you know or what you've read, and if you are going to speculate, please identify it as speculation. What was it about these two guys and their background and potentially their mother and their father? What was it about them that got them on the Russian watch list? Why were the Russians watching these people? Because we should appreciate that the Russians gave us a heads up. But what were they doing that caused them to get on the Russian watch list?
Well, I think first thing to understand is that this family's ethnic roots are in Chechnya. Chechnya is a Russian republic in the Caucasus, that isthmus of land that sits between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea in southern Russia. It's been a thoroughfare for invasion and warfare for literally centuries. It is the route by which the initial Islamic onslaught came north against the Christian Slavs. That is the place where, if you will, they were cut off at the pass. That is where the Islamic onslaught was stopped, and it's become a battleground. It's been a battleground for at least 1,000 years. It remains so today. So that is the ethnic roots of the family. And going back in history, Chechenian families have been uprooted. They've been oppressed. They've been deported, exiled from Stalin, even before that, and have fought vicious bloody wars against Russia in the 1990s.
Okay, I think most of the listeners know that the Chechens and Chechen rebels and the terrorist attacks that they've made within Russia have been devastating, including that school of several years ago where hundreds of students were killed.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone knows, I believe, that the Chechens are a major problem for the Russians. So my question is, you have a son, the older son, and perhaps parents. The son comes to the United States. So why wouldn't the Russians say, good riddance, this guy is out of Russia, he's out of Chechnya, he's not going to bother us anymore, he's gone off to find, you know, to fall in love with America, whatever the case may be. Why would the Russians take the time to warn us against some potential radical
that's left their country and come to the United States. Why would they do that? And take us inside that thought process.
Because he went back. Because Tamerlane, the older brother, went back to Chechnya. At least in 2011, certainly for a six-month period, January to June in 2012. He tripped across the security services in Russia, perhaps in Chechnya, certainly in Dagestan. We have a report from NBC affiliate in Boston, I've seen, that reported the city police, I guess city police in the capital of Dagestan, it's called Makhachkala, were surveilling some other individual, a jihadist kind of a leader, at a particular mosque that was known to be a Salafist jihadist mosque. And along comes Tamerlane. He tripped across their surveillance lines, and he was in contact with the person that the Dagestani police had been watching. In other words, he was in contact with this jihad leader. He not only met with that person once, he met with them six times. The Russians took that report. That's the report that they gave to the Russians. The Russians gave to the FBI and said, look, not only, the first report was about him radicalizing, okay? That was 2011. The practical, this is what he's doing now. He's actually in Dagestan meeting with this guy. We know that there are a number of jihad organizations over there. The most powerful of them, most influential, is something called the Caucasus Emirate, led by a Chechen whose name is Doku Umarov. We don't know if that is the group or individual from that group with whom Tamerlane met.
Let me interject for just a question, for a point here. Based on what you know, and again, if you're speculating, tell us that you're speculating. What does your gut tell you about whether or not these two brothers were directed in some way by either Chechen or Muslim or Al-Qaeda or some extremist element beyond the United States, or were they just two lone dogs who happened to be brothers?
Now, there's a network here. There's an extensive network. I think part of it does lie in the Caucasus. Another part of it probably lies in the United States. We know that the mosque these two brothers attended in Cambridge, part of the Islamic Society of Boston system. It is a Muslim Brotherhood system. Founders include people like Abdulrahman Alamoudi, Al-Qaeda financier, terrorist, now serving a prison term in jail. Other founder includes trustee Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the senior jurist of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is the mosque that they attended in Cambridge. So I think part of the influence is there. We have seen those reports about an individual, an older man, whose name only has been given so far as Misha, an Armenian named Misha, a convert to Islam, is the reporting, who is very influential on the two brothers, in particular the older one, Tamerlane.
Claire, the uncle, who was quoted in the first couple of days, and then we haven't seen much from him, was involved in a case out here in Chicago in 2002, because he had forwarded to a variety of individuals on a mailing list a request for contributions under the aegis of a so-called charity based out here in the southwest suburbs of the city of Chicago that was raising money. It was found in federal court here in Chicago to have been raising money for jihad.
Claire, we have to pause for a commercial break right now. But when we come back, I want to switch gears from Boston for a moment. 1-800-723-8289 if people have questions for you. But I want to talk about another story that broke this week that got not as much follow-up as I would like it to be. And that's the attempt to terrorize on a railroad. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're joined by Claire Lopez. She's a fellow with the Center for Security Policy at the Clarion Fund. Before the break, Claire, and when we were setting up this interview, you shared with me sort of a concern that I had. Was there another big story this week was the breaking up of a plot to terrorize, to use terrorist tactics, involving rail between Canada and the United States. And it was a one-day story, at least on the network news. There hasn't been too much about it. Most of the discussions have been about Boston and who dropped the ball. But in your view, What is the bigger ramification of that story, and where might that story lead, or is it somehow tied with what happened in Boston?
Well, in the broader sense, yes, it is tied, because that attack plot as well is perpetrated by Islamic jihadis aiming to cause harm to North Americans, Americans and Canadians in this case. In that plot, you've got two individuals, one Tunisian-born, Jaheb Essengaye, and one born in the United Arab Emirates, Raya Jasser, two people under arrest now in Canada, who were acting with the direction, under the direction, under the command and control of the Al-Qaeda Shura Council that's been operating out of Iran ever since 9/11. And the big picture here, what's important about this is that we recognize that Iran and Al-Qaeda have been working against us in an operational terror alliance since the early 1990s. And their attacks that they perpetrated against the United States include Khobar Towers, East Africa Embassy bombings, USS Cole, and, yes, 9/11. That
Claire,
was an Iran-Al-Qaeda joint operation.
Bob Creamer is here, and he wants to challenge you on a couple of points. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, just two quick things. I mean, and as most listeners may or may not know, I mean, in general, Al-Qaeda, which is a Sunni organization, and the Iranian government, which is, of course, a Shia operation, have been at massive odds every place from Syria to throughout the last decade and a half. And just so just a note that of caution when one says, oh, geez, they're parallel operations. Number two, Claire, I'm just concerned that you clarify. You were not arguing earlier that everyone who's a Muslim is somehow called to jihad or is that the religion itself is incompatible with democracy, were you?
Yes, I absolutely was.
I was afraid of that.
Absolutely. I have studied Islamic doctrine, law, and scripture at great length. I've co-authored a book about Sharia law. There's just simply no two ways about it. The doctrine, the law, and the scripture of Islam are unequivocal. All Muslims are commanded to jihad.
But Claire,
now,
are you?
Thankfully,
would you say
the vast
Claire,
majority in the entire world either don't know this
right.
or they disobey this.
Right.
And may the disobedient Muslims please be fruitful and multiply, as I always say.
Right, right. So, Claire, in terms of we're in Chicago where, you know, Martin Marty, the University of Chicago, fundamentalism is observed as very important. Would you say, would you agree that the, let's say, fundamentalist-inspired political Islam takes those charges very seriously, whereas the average Muslim businessman in Jakarta probably isn't even aware of it?
That may be so, yeah. I mean, an awful lot of people, like I say, of any faith, probably don't obey the doctrine of their faith. Lots of Christians skip church on Sunday, and I know Jews who eat pork. I mean, those aren't exactly doctrinal issues, but as an example. But to the other question there about the Sunni-Shiite conflict and how they overcome that, there's something in the Islamic world called the balanced opposition. Balanced opposition means that at the lowest level of conflict, I against my brother and I against our cousin, I think many have heard this. At the macro level, when you take that to the top, you've got something called Dar al-Islam, those places which are ruled by Sharia, Islamic law, versus Dar al-Harb, those places that are not under the Sharia law. And so while at local levels like Iraq and Syria, Shiites and Sunnis, since the split, after the death of Muhammad in 632, happily slaughter away at one another, at the macro level, it is about Islam versus all of non-Islam. Now, I will also mention to your listeners, I was an expert witness in a legal case called the Havlish case. They can find all the documents for this at www.iran911case.com. And in that case, survivors and widows, in particular, of the 9/11 attacks, brought suit in a court of law, Southern District of New York, in which Judge George Daniels, December 2011, ruled in court that Iran was co-responsible, together with Hezbollah, and Al Qaeda for the attacks of 9/11.
For those that just tuned in, I want to make sure that we heard you correctly earlier. When it is your allegation that U.S. intelligence, that it's more than just about failing to connect the dots, in your view, there is a systemic problem within American intelligence that is bending over backwards to looking beyond a basic education. In other words, they don't want to be totally educated on what the goals of radical Islam is for politically correct reasons. I need a 15-second answer to that question.
Okay. Muslim Brotherhood advisors have so deeply penetrated the United States government that it is at their demand and request that this kind of training has been purged. It's at the demand of the Muslim Brotherhood, the advisors that advise our senior national security officials.
We are out of time.
This is sheer fantasy, Claire.
We are out of time. We have disagreements of that.
It's sheer
fantasy.
Claire Lopez, fellow, the Center for Security Policy. Bob Kramer says it's fantasy. John, you got a one-word answer?
I think I'm with Bob Kramer on that.
Okay. Chris Veronis and Chris Roebling all join us. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. And thanks to Dan Dorfman and Tom Veracruz for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next Sunday night, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.